Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. Tracy Schultz is my engineer. How are you, Tracy, today?
Doing well. Thank you so much.
It's always fun. It's a beautiful day out there, isn't it?
Yeah, we got kind of lucky there.
Yeah, it's getting chilly at night, but, you know, we don't mean to rub it in to all you folks listening in other parts of the country. God, especially where there's some really crazy weather happening right now, and I don't want to take that lightly.
But, yeah, I don't want to jinx it. Yeah.
No, so. Okay, Rag Radio comes your way every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. We're in the studios of Co-op Radio in Austin, Texas. Co-op is a community radio station. It's cooperatively run and all volunteer. It's a pretty unique station. All the programming, everything is decided by the staff. So it's a very cool place. Rag Radio is also rebroadcast on several other community radio stations in Pennsylvania, in California, in Houston. We're on our podcast, gets wide distribution. So we're all over the place. If you're interested in listening to any of our podcasts or finding out more, go to theragblog.com/ragradio, theragblog.com/ragradio. You can find links to all the shows we've ever done. All right. Anything else I should say, Tracy?
No.
Okay. Well, good.
I think that covers it nicely. Yeah.
Okay. And I, you know, this, I have a youngster on today, Ken Light. I think you got started in the movement about 4 years after I did. So that's, you know, so I have a big head jump on you.
There you go.
There you go. Ken Light is a documentary photographer whose latest book is What's Going On? Photographs from 1969 to 1974. The book features work that reflected his as a young radical vision, as you mentioned in an email to me, in the late 60s, early 70s, when he was a photographer for Liberation News Service in New York. And I should note that that I actually worked with Liberation News Service a little bit before Ken. So we shared, and Liberation News Service is an extremely important institution in the movement, and I think we might actually talk a little bit about that. We get criticized because we talk a lot about the 60s, and we talk a lot about the underground press, but I think it's important because we actually have some direct knowledge of it, and people don't know about it, and people in the 60s themselves get misrepresented so widely that I think it's always good if we can have some. So. Okay, Ken Light has worked as a freelance documentary photographer for 45 years, focusing on social issues facing America. His work has been published in 9 books, including Valley of Shadows and Dreams, Coal Hollow, Delta Time, To the Promised Land, With These Hands, and Texas Death Row. And we'll talk about that especially. He's the author of Witness in Our Time, Working Lives of Documentary Photographers, now in its second edition. And his work has been published all over the place. He is the Reva and David Logan Professor of Photojournalism at the Graduate School of Journalism at University of California at Berkeley. And he's the 2012 Leventhal Visiting Professor at Oklahoma University, Graduate School of Journalism. Columbia University Graduate
Columbia.
School. What did I say?
Oklahoma.
How in the world? I'm looking at Columbia and I said Oklahoma. Oh, Oklahoma. All right. His website is www.kenlight.com. And people should read, Ken Wachsberger wrote a review of Ken's new book in the Rag Blog, and you can find that. Go to theragblog.com. He titled it Ken Light's Photographic Journey Through the Chaos and the Calm, which I thought was kind of cool. So that's it. That's our introduction, Mr. Oklahoma. How are you, Ken?
I am good. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great. It's great to have you. There's so much we can talk about, I think. And here's where I'd like to start. There's an article that was written that was published this week in American Photography by David, is it Schonauer?
Schonauer.
And he starts off the article, says, in the spring of 1970, when Ken Light went off to photograph the rioting at Ohio State University that followed the U.S. invasion of Cambodia, All he had with him was a Pentax K1000 SLR, a 50mm lens, some rolls of Kodak Tri-X film, a light meter, and a gas mask. Light himself
the
was
last part was the most important part.
Absolutely. Heck with all the rest. Light himself was a student at the time at the University of Ohio in Athens, and he remembers vividly the day he hitchhiked north to Columbus. I look back on it now and say and think, wow, how did I do it? So tell us about that. Tell us about how you got started, and it's obviously with photography, and I think you didn't get started so much as a photographer, thinking of you were going to be a photographer, as you did just wanting to document what you were seeing around you, which I guess is the way you started.
Yeah, I went off to college in 69. I became an anti-war organizer, one of the leaders of the Athens Peace Committee, and my dad had always been interested in photography, so I had a camera. I dabbled in it. And those times, I mean, 69 was just, you know, an amazing time of young people exploding with energy and wanting to change things and the possibility of change, the repression of the government, and even on a college campus, you know, not wanting to hear the voices of young people. We couldn't vote if you weren't 21, which was kind of crazy. And I had a camera, and as an organizer going off to the moratorium, I took it and started taking pictures. And that was kind of, you know, really dabbling, in it. And it was funny because my fellow organizers would often, you know, complain, you know, you're not doing your job, you're taking pictures. And then they would come to me 3 days later and say, oh, can we have a picture? And things, of course, started to, the movement started to grow and grow and grow. And by the spring of 1970, really, you know, we went from, you know, at least in Ohio, from demonstrations of 100 to 200 to 300 people to, you know, many thousands. Young people just realizing what was happening with the war and issues around women's liberation, black power. I mean, all these issues were coming to kind of a crescendo. And there had been a number one night of rioting in Columbus, Ohio, around these issues. And the governor, Governor Rhodes, called out the National Guard to show up that evening and the next day, and that's when I decided I needed to go up there and see what was happening. And that's literally, you know, hitchhiked. And as David said, you know, my camera, my 50mm lens, a bunch of Tri-X 35mm film, my gas mask, and a press pass that I had gotten from the campus newspaper, the Ohio University Post. And showed up in the early morning, there they were, the National Guard, kids my age with helmets and gas masks and bayonets, and trying to corral thousands of young people who were completely angered by the announcement of the Cambodian invasion, which was supposed to be secret, of course. And I began to photograph. And with a, you know, those of your listeners who do photography or dabble in photography, you can imagine just with a 50mm lens, you know, not a telephoto or 180mm lens, you have to be very, very close. And you know, partly I'm 19 years old. This is my group. I fit right in, and compared to the news photographers who are working for the news, for the, you know, mainstream media, who are, you know, probably wearing ties and short hair and kind of see us young people in this movement as kind of ragamuffins, troublemakers, radicals, and so forth.
Yeah, Ken Waxberger quoted you as saying, "It was my life, not my assignment."
Yes, it was my life.
And that's
the great part of this whole book for me. It was my life. It's what I observed, and the events I went to really had a vision of how I wanted the world to be, like so many of us did, on the progressive left, and also those of us working on underground newspapers. And so I made photographs of the riots, and All of a sudden, I found as I was shooting, these two arms grabbed me from behind, and was two Ohio Highway Patrol officers, and said, "You're under arrest," and grabbed me and took me to a paddy wagon, handcuffed me, and I said, "You know, I'm a journalist. I have a press pass. It's on my, you know, army jacket, right?" my green army jacket.
Yeah.
And they looked at the press pass and they ripped it off and ripped it into little pieces and threw it up in the air like confetti and said
"What
not
press
a journalist
pass?
Anymore.
Wow.
And took me to jail with about 300 other people that day. Took my film and my gas mask and my camera, put it in the bag, and when I got out of jail, bailed out by the head of Ohio American Civil Liberties Union, my film was there, which was kind of remarkable, and I was charged with inciting to riot, 3 to 5 years in prison, possibility. I hitchhiked back to Athens, developed the film, and sent it off to Liberation News Service. I mean, in those days, you developed the film in the darkroom, you made 8x10 prints in the darkroom, put it in an envelope.
How prehistoric. I said, how prehistoric.
Yes, very prehistoric. Very permanent, though, but prehistoric. The pictures landed at LNS, and they printed it in the packet, the news packet, which one of the pictures made the cover, which, of course, was, you know, the prize place for a photographer to have your cover on your picture on the cover of Liberation News Service. And that got distributed all over the world to their subscribers. And in those days, as you remember, you know, having worked on the Rag and also Space City, you know, there were, what, about 650 underground newspapers in the U.S., which was, you know, quite remarkable. And I think in this generation, hard to even imagine that young people had that kind of power and voice with our writing and our words and the things we were thinking about. The pictures were published literally all over the world. I mean, you know, you're 19 years old and people are telling you, you know, here's the cover of the Cuban newspaper and your picture's on the front cover. I had a colleague, Mike Schuster, who went to Africa to photograph and said, you know, I saw your pictures in the newspapers in Africa. And, of course, then all over the U.S. and underground newspapers. And, you know, it was that moment I realized the idea of not only being an activist and interested in changing America, but the power of witnessing what was going on. I mean, I had a sense, even at 19, that, you know, we were making history, and those things needed to be recorded from a different perspective. And that's what I try to do.
At that point, did you actually realize that maybe you were going to devote your life to this, that this was the way you were going to participate in the movement and in social change would be through the lens?
I think at that point I got the inkling that was possible. You know, we were lucky. We grew up in an age where gas was 29 cents a gallon and rents were cheap, and there wasn't quite the pressure there is now to immediately go out and get a job. You could really... you know, I worked at Burger Boy Foodorama, flipping hamburgers and doing those kind of odd jobs and selling a picture here and there for $15. And really what was most important to me was recording, you know, the things that I saw around me, not only the movement activities, but as you can see in the book, you know, this great swath of America that was completely unseen. You know, the poverty in St. Louis, the conditions in Appalachia, issues around race. And I just started literally hitchhiking all over the country and then periodically going to cover what I thought were some of the major events of the times. And in those days, it was fairly easy to get credentialed. Fairly easy to get up close. Unlike today, where I think they're much more savvy about how people are represented through their images, and there's a lot more control.
I should tell people that this book, the book about the 1670s, is called "What's Going On 1969 to 1974" by Ken Light. It's a big book. It's a rich book. It's it's photographers all the way till, I don't know, the last little chunk of the book, in which there is an excellent essay. Ken communicates as well through words as he does through pictures. And it's really a terrific book. And one of the things it does is it doesn't just present, you know, the counterculture, the hippies, the new left, the protests and whatever, but it also, it presents the other side. It presents the people who, you know, there's a lot of wonderful imagery of like people with Nixon hats and whatever. I mean, the opposition to, and those who were kind of freaking out because of the cultural change that was happening. And then also folks just in their everyday lives. And I think it's unique in that it gives a really overall and pretty textured picture of what was happening in the world at that time.
Thank you. And America was at war with itself. And I think that's part of wanting to show these two opposites, including what regular Americans were doing. And that was really, for me, an important part of the story. And, you know, you can imagine, you know, being a young progressive, you know, political radical photographer and your credential to travel with Richard Nixon. I mean, it was, you know, incredible in Ohio, you know, with other journalists. And I remember, I talk about this in the memoir at the end of the book, traveling with him through five cities in northern Ohio, and at one point getting off the press truck and moving towards him, and all of a sudden I find myself literally face-to-face with President Nixon. And he looks at me with horror because I have very long hair. And I look at him thinking, oh, my God, it's the architect of the Vietnam War right there, right in front of me. And we just both kind of, you know, didn't know what to do.
You have some great. You also have a great. You have a great picture of Henry Kissinger, incidentally, in here that I love.
Yeah, right.
So you
and,
got
and,
some
and
up
that's
close.
Another one. You know, can you imagine? You know, that was taken in '72 at the Republican convention in Miami, where there were, you know, amazing demonstrations, and where the convention hall got tear gassed because the air conditioners in Miami pulled in the tear gas into the convention hall, and they were, you know, of course, gassing the demonstrators out in the streets outside and around the convention hall. You know, again, there I am on the floor of the convention with long hair, and there's, my God, Henry Kissinger right in front of me. And with a 50-millimeter lens, just he and I just look at each other very deeply, and boom, there's the picture. So as you said, there's a wide range of these pictures, just giving a sense of who we were and what the era was. And, you know, a lot of the images appeared in, you know, The Great Speckled Bird, The Old Mole, The L.A. Free Press, The Black Panther Newspaper, The Ann Arbor Sun, NOLA Express in Louisiana, and, of course, you know, Space City and The Rag. So it's just been fun and very exciting to kind of go through the archives and go through all the hundreds of rolls of film that I made on this journey and kind of figure out for myself, you know, what happened and who were we and what was this era about?
Okay. I think now would be a good time. We need to take a break pretty quickly. Let's take it now because we're at a good stopping point, Tracy. And we'll be back in just a minute. We're talking with Ken Light, who is a documentary photographer. We're talking about his book on the 60s and 70s, but he's been doing extraordinary work ever since. 45 years, I believe.
Yes.
Right? Yes. Okay. So we'll be right back after this. I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is RAG Radio.
Revolution. One generation got old, one generation
Okay, the Jefferson Airplane. I remember when that came out and how wonderful it was, how much I loved it. Ken gave us a few suggestions for songs, and they were all iconic. How do you choose?
That's a good
one.
There
was some music during that era, wasn't there? I mean, it's really wonderful.
Oh, boy, I'm telling you. Okay, I want to talk. I love this quote, from that American Photography story. He said, I would love to say that I was a brilliant young – we're talking with Ken Light, documentary photographer, and we're talking about his book, What's Going On, Photographs from 1969 to 1974, and we're going to be talking about his work since. But you said, I would love to say that I was a brilliant young photographer and knew exactly what I was doing, but I was really just following my nose and watching what was going on. Here's a question. All right, this book, and then we're going to move on to some other stuff in a minute. But this book, and it's a big, handsome book, you self-published it. You said that when you first were putting it together or had the idea that you had a lot of interest, but that ultimately you said maybe right now people aren't quite ready to revisit the 60s or whatever.
It's really very, very interesting how our culture looks at eras, and they seem like they have to be far away from it to kind of examine it. And I think this era in particular, people are still very divided over it, divided over the Vietnam War, divided over the things that we were struggling around and things that have changed. And this is my ninth book. All my other books have been published by Aperture, Smithsonian, UC Press, Heyday, etc. And I went to a number of publishers, and initially they were very, very excited about them, and then they kind of lost interest. One publisher said, oh, I hate Nixon.
<It's> like, there you
okay.
go.
and I think there's just the fear that, what this era is about, and the fear that people are not ready to kind of look at it. And so we are in this amazing era of disruption, a different type of disruption than, 69 to 74, but it nonetheless disruption. And part of, I guess, the good side of this disruption that's happening is I was able to go onto Kickstarter and raise the money from over 430 individuals who pre-bought the book and supported it in many other ways financially to self-publish it. And so I'm trying to literally disrupt the way that, somewhat like an underground newspaper, I guess, disrupt the way we publish. And this gave me the ability to really do the kind of book I wanted to do. And as you said, it's a very, very large book. It's beautifully, beautifully printed. I'm distributing it pretty much by myself, and people can go to my website, www.kenlight.com, and they'll see what's going on the book, and they can just click on that, and it'll take them right to the spot where they can buy a copy. And so that was very exciting, and it did allow me to do the type of book I wanted to do. Working directly with the designer, and one of the fun parts was including some of my FBI file.
I love that.
as the end papers in the book, and putting in a timeline of the era, and you probably publishing more pictures. There's 139 photographs in the book itself than maybe a traditional publisher might want to publish.
You did it through, you crowdfunded it and raised $45,000 in 30 days, right?
Yes, correct.
That's some major kickstarting.
So, yeah, it was pretty remarkable.
You also said, and this, I love this, then there's another horrible moment when you get a call that 175 cases of books are arriving via ship, and where do you want them? You
yes.
said that self-publishing.
Well, not only that, but packing, boxing 400 books and taking them down to the post office. Imagine that.
it's hard to imagine when I think, we used to put together those packets at LNS and put them in the mail. That was something.
That's right, in mail sacks. And right. think about all the underground newspapers and standing on the street and selling them.
But we're getting up there. We can't carry all that stuff anymore.
That's true. Luckily, I have some assistants who are young photographers who want to help.
I wanted to say, by the way, when you were talking about, you know, that you freaked out Nixon and the like because you were kind of long-haired and great. Well, you don't have that long hair anymore.
No, so I wish I did.
But a lot of it went to your mustache, so you got that. So.
That's right. So. The last place I can grow hair.
Okay. I think that this is that what you've done is really pretty amazing, and I think people should give us give us where people should go. Give us the website again where people can get.
Yeah, the easiest place is just to go to www.kenlight, KENLIGHT, oneword.com. And that's my website. And when they get to my website, they'll see all the books I've done. And if you just click on what's going on, you can't miss it. It's big and has an American flag on the cover. It's beautifully printed cloth cover, hardbound book. And they can just click on that, and that will take them to the website where they can order the book. There's a regular book. There's a slipcase book that's more money, and there's also high-end books for $350 where there's actually a darkroom print, silver print made by me in the darkroom that comes with the book. So there's a lot of different options. But the book itself is $55, it's very, very easy to do.
Memorandum to the acting director, FBI. Considering the fact that Light is associated, and they do Light in all caps, is associated with the, quote, underground press, it is felt that an interview with him could prove embarrassing to the Bureau. It is therefore recommended that Kenneth Randall Light, in all caps, not be interviewed at this time. Well, that was nice.
Yeah, that's pretty nice, isn't it?
Yeah, I like that. But there's all this. There's all these FBI memoranda with lots of stuff blacked out, redacted.
Redacted, yeah.
Redacted. It's all redacted. Okay. All right. Then after, of course, a lot of us, the movement kind of ended. You know, it was in some ways that we did a lot of important stuff. We changed a lot of things. I think we really had an impact on and played a major role in stopping the war. But there was a point then where I think ultimately, since we had these sort of, you know, we want the world and we want it now kind of goals. We weren't going to be satisfied with anything short of an absolute transformation of the world. There was a lot of sense that we didn't succeed. There was and people suddenly were becoming adults.
Yeah.
And had to figure out what to do with their lives. And we're not necessarily a lot of us. Some of us that dropped out of school to start underground newspapers. I won't mention any names. And transition periods. So how did you then move into this becoming part of your life and this kind of work becoming part of your life?
Well, of course, you know, working with the underground press.
Especially remunerative part of your life.
Yeah, well, that's the hard part. I moved to California in 73. I actually worked at an underpants warehouse. And
well, we all did that. You know.
Yeah, right? I told them I had a lie that I didn't have a coach because they would not have hired me. And I did that for 4 or 5 months, and then I got a job working, doing design and layout for a weekly shopper, you know, advertising grocery stores and so forth, that gave me the flexibility of only having to work, you know, I think it was 2 or 3 nights and a couple days. Never told them I was a photographer, and just started taking pictures and then started slowly freelancing. And then eventually was able to start teaching part-time and eventually, you know, turned into a full-time job at UC Berkeley as doing photography. I continued to be interested in the world around me, and when I first came to California, I began to photograph in West Oakland, which was an all-black community that now is getting completely gentrified, but in those days it was kind of the most impoverished part of the city. And then eventually started photographing agricultural workers, which seems like a traditional thing that photographers do in California. We have the great history of Dorothea Lange and Hansel Meath and other photographers who have gone out into the agricultural areas of California.
And David Bacon now.
David Bacon.
There's a lot of that. And our own Alan Pogue has done that, too.
Many photographers. It's so important to do. I mean, that subject matter, because it's just completely unchanged from, you know, the days that Lang photographed, you know, in the 30s and 40s. And that was then my first published book, called With These Hands, with an introduction by Cesar Chavez, who was still alive at that time. And that book, I traveled all over the U.S. photographing agricultural workers, including in Texas. I mean, I actually started in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas, and I realized the conditions there were so horrible for farm workers, and there was a lot of child labor, which is what drew me to the Rio Grande Valley in the first place. That if I only photographed in Texas, people would say, oh, it's only in Texas. And I think that's part of my understanding of doing this work is, you know, there will be pushback against the type of images you make in terms of what you do when getting those pictures published, and somehow you have to kind of figure out how you can broaden your perspective so that you can get your pictures out into the world, you know, mainstream publications, Newsweek, Time, newspapers, etc. So I started that book in Texas, and then I traveled all over the U.S., and I was fortunate in those days we had the National Endowment for the Arts actually funding photographers and other artists, and got an NEA grant that allowed me to continue that. And as I was doing that project, I began to see more and more undocumented workers working in the fields coming through the fences along the border. And this was in 1979, 1980. And as I was finishing the farm worker book, I realized, my God, this is one of the great stories in America. These people coming through, you know, from at that time, largely from Mexico into the U.S. I decided at the end of, as I was about to finish this book on farm workers, that I would try to travel with the INS along the border. And it was a time in which, it was pretty easy again to get permission to do that. I traveled with the INS in California along the in El Centro, and along between El Centro and Tijuana, with the INS for a week, going at night from 5 in the afternoon until 7 in the morning, traveling with them, photographing. And I realized, I included a couple of those pictures in that first book, and then I realized, you know, this was, I mean, my family came from Eastern Europe in the late 1800s, and we have no pictures of where we came from, what that experience was, etc., and that I kind of had a responsibility to kind of document this. And so I spent the next 4 years traveling along the border, doing a lot of ride-alongs with the INS, going into Mexico to photograph in Oaxaca and Michoacán. I went into Texas along the Rio Grande and photographed along the Rio Grande, and I did a book then called To the Promised Land, which right. looks at immigration in this era, at a time when the headlines of newspapers had, you know, the Brown invasion. That was kind of the mainstream press's vision of what was going on. And there were, I mean, 1 year, I think the first year I photographed, the INS had apprehended 1.3 million people coming into the U.S. Illegally. And they were capturing, I think they said, 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. So it was pretty incredible time to do that.
Okay. So, I mean, unless you want to finish that narrative,
No.
Okay. I think I feel a need to take this opportunity to ask you what you think about what's going on now with the anti-immigrant hysteria, with Trump, with, you know, the sort of, I mean, you saw all of this then. You could have gone ahead and built Trump's wall. I mean,
I could have. Yes. And in those you know. Days, it's funny to look back at that work and look at the pictures. It was a cyclone fence, like you'd find in a schoolyard. That was the fence.
Right. Right.
And I mean, it's hysteria. I mean, people don't really understand the give and take between, you know, Mexico and the U.S. and what happens. And I always, when I finally went into Mexico to really, I mean, deeply within Mexico, to photograph both in Michoacán and then Morelia and around Morelia, I mean, you realize how much change is happening in Mexico because of people coming to the U.S. and what they bring back, the culture they bring back, and how culturally I think rural Mexico was partly destroyed by people coming back from the U.S. to visit their families, and this idea of how great it was, and it really wasn't very great for people who came here. I mean, their conditions were horrible. And again, in the book, it has those pictures of people living in the tenements and the hard work and getting ripped off. And I think that the hysteria now, people don't really understand why people come here to have a better life, like my family came, you know, to find a better life, to make more money, to have opportunity. And wow, you know, if those immigrants, if they rounded up those immigrants and sent them all back, like
our economy would come to a dead stop.
The economy would collapse completely.
Yeah.
They're not even thinking about.
No, that's crazy. Okay, we're going to take another break. I did want to read this. I think I found this on your website. You said, as John, is it Sarkowski?
Yes, John Sarkowski
said in his important book, Mirrors and Windows, photographers are either mirrors or they're windows. Either looking into the world or they're reflecting their own experiences. I thought that was pretty cool. And I guess that's part of what you're doing as a documentary photographer, especially when you come out of being an activist yourself and photographing the things that you were personally involved in, I guess. So are you a mirror?
I think I'm a little bit of both, you know?
Well, we're all a little bit of all of it. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is Drag Radio. My guest is documentary photographer Ken Light, whose latest book is What's Going On? Photographs from 1969 to 1974. We'll be right back. I'm Thorne Dreyer.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing. Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen, and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. And don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. For the loser now will be later to win, for the times they are a-changing. Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that gets hurt will be he who has stalled. The battle outside raging will soon shake your windows and rattle your walls. For the times, they are a-changing.
Ken Light, you had a picture in your book, and I tried to thumb through it and couldn't find it real quick, of some high school kids. I think they were high school kids sort of crouched outside school smoking, and there were about four or five of them. And one of them was just a dead ringer for the young Bobby D, or the young Bobby,
yes,
young Bobby Z, I guess. He was still Bobby Z then. Going through the book, I just found so many things that just registered, you know. I mean, for one thing, I found some friends, Abby Hoffman.
Oh, that's nice.
Well, Abby and, you know.
Yeah, of course.
But Ken Light is our guest on Rag Radio. Ken is a documentary photographer, and we're going to talk about not only his wonderful book on the 60s, which you can get at Ken Light. Photography.com? No, just KenLight.com.
KenLight.com. KenLight.com. Or, you know, the alternative, of course, is Amazon, but you can get it there. But it's more fun to get it directly from me because it's
especially more. It's more. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Like mine is.
Yeah, like yours is, absolutely.
Right, right, and it's cool. It's a cool signature. It's right there on the page. All right, let's talk about the book you did about the Texas death row. And it was called, in fact, Texas Death Row.
It is called Texas Death Row. That's correct. University of Mississippi Press. It was really outside of the kind of work that I normally do. So the subject matter that I look at, if you look at the arc of my career, To the Promised Land, Delta Time, I did Cold Hollow, Valley of Shadows and Dreams, kind of looking at communities and people in those communities. But in 93, Suzanne Donovan, who actually at that point had just been director of the Texas American Civil Liberties Union and who was a good friend of mine, called me one day and said, I'm wanting to do something important. I'm in Texas, and I want to do a book on Texas death row. You want to work with me? And I'm like, sure, knowing this would never happen, because it's very, very difficult for photographers to gain access to prisons. Prisons, I mean, in a death row, of course, is the deepest, darkest, hidden place. But even just to get into a prison for more than a couple of hours is very difficult. They limit the access. They don't want photographers inside photographing and witnessing. And so I said yes to her, knowing it would never happen. And she knew many, many people in Texas. She did a lot of networking and finally found a person who worked under Governor Ann Richards, and that person knew the director of the prison system, and he said to her, yes, they can go into Texas death row. And the funny thing was, Suzanne called me, and this was in, I think, December of 93, and said, we have permission. I'm like, what does that mean? She says, I don't know. They just said, we have permission.
What kind of access does that mean?
Yeah,
I guess that's the real
mean?
Question. Yeah.
So I said, I need to come to Huntsville, which is where most of the prisons in Texas are, state prisons, and we need to find out what this means. And so I flew to Texas. Suzanne and I had a meeting set up with the director of Texas Department of Criminal Justice, and I will never forget that morning. We arrived at the building in Huntsville. We walked in into the office, and there was the director's secretary, and he turned to us and he said, "Oh, the director has left in an emergency, but the two PR people from the prison system are in the director's office, and they've been told you have unlimited access," which is, my God, for a journalist,
wow,
for a photographer, those words are so sweet, Thorne. I mean, those are the best words you can ever hear, unlimited
right.
access.
Right.
No one really knows what it means, but it's fabulous. And so we walked into the director's office.
One thing you don't is if you don't know what there is to access.
Well, of course. Yes. So we walked into the director's office, and, you know, it's a typical, I want to say, prison warden's office with the Longhorn spearheads, the barbed wire collection, the Remington repeating rifle on the wall, and all that stuff.
Those Longhorns were all executed, too, by the way.
And there were the two PR guys, and they had lightning bolts coming out of their eyes at us. And they said, well, we want to know how you got permission. And we basically said, you know, all you need to know is we have unlimited access. And they're like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, we've never been on death row, so we need to really see it to tell you what we want. And they said, okay. So they drove us over to the Ellis unit, which is where the death row was at that time. This is in late 93.
Right.
And we did a walkthrough with the warden and the head of the death row. And we went to they had a factory at that time where death row inmates sewed shirts for the prison system and through the cell blocks. And then I'll never forget, we went to, the warden took us to lunch in the prison cafeteria, which was, you know, very Texas chicken fried steak, you know, with yeast buns and lots of gravy.
Yum.
Yes. And then he said, well, what do you want to do? And
I said, I bet the prisoners weren't getting that.
No, no. what do you want to do? And I said, well, I want to come back for a week and photograph to start. And he said, fine, you'll come for 5 days. And I said, no, a week, 7 days. And he says, oh, okay. So I set up an appointment in January, and which was very stupid of me. I came back to California. And then I thought that was dumb because now they have time to think about it. They didn't. And I came back in January and showed up, and they let me in, and I began to photograph. And I photographed, I ended up making 3 trips. Each trip was 7 days over 1994. And Suzanne had networked throughout with lawyers whose clients were on the row. And so when I went in that first day, I had a list of inmates to meet and talk to who knew that they could trust us and what we were trying to do. And that helped, that networking helped a great deal to get, you know, for the inmates to feel comfortable with what I was going to do photographically.
Did you know starting out what you were going to do, or did you kind of feel your way through it?
No, I completely felt my way through it. I mean, I try to do a little bit of research on death row in Texas, but no one had ever been in death row. The only photographer who had photographed in Texas was Danny Lyon,
yeah.
who did a book called Conversations with the Dead.
Right, I've got
it. In the late 60s, which right. was you know, remarkable, still is a remarkable body of work. He had one picture of Old Sparky, the electric chair. But he never was allowed onto the row. He photographed in general population, but he photographed in the Ellis unit. So I could have a visual sense of what the Ellis unit was about. I showed up. I had an escort, an unarmed escort with me that would, you know, allow me to, you know, them to open up the cell blocks for me to go in. The only rules they had where I needed to get a model release signed by every inmate I photographed, and I could not go into anyone's cells, which I ignored. The guards would stand outside for you know, being scared of going in, and I would, particularly in the work capable unit, which was open, I would just walk into inmates' cells, and I would talk to them and photograph them.
Did you tape? Did you do any interviews or just do the photography?
Suzanne did interviews.
Okay.
So Suzanne only went inside twice, and she did interviews in the visiting room. So the thing that they allowed her to do was to call any inmate out she wanted to whenever she showed up, which was very unusual, and she could sit and talk to them for 4 or 5 hours about their lives. But, you know, as a photographer, you have to get into it. You have to be in the cells. You have to observe what's going on, the exercises, do the portraits of the inmates. And it was incredibly intense to hear the life stories of these men. To witness it, I was against the death penalty, and coming out, I'm against the death penalty. And as we all know, Texas was then and is still the most active death row in America. And the year I photographed in '94, they executed 19 men. I try to photograph every day as if it would be the last day of taking pictures. So the first day I just shot as much as I could, thinking that the second day they'd say, no, you can't do it anymore. But no, they let me come back a second day, and the second day I figured the third day they wouldn't let me in. But so every day, you know, I photographed as much as I could. And then at the end of the week, I left and said I was going to come back again, and I did in April of '94. I came back for my second trip, and when I arrived on the row, I realized an inmate by the name of Richard Beavers was going to be executed while I was there, and I would be able to photograph the process of him of going through the execution. And of course, I needed to get a model release, you know, from him, and this was one of the requirements that they gave to me. And I went up to his cell. This was about 4 days before his execution, and he was a volunteer. He gave up his appeals, so we knew he was going to be executed. And he said, no, I couldn't photograph him. And, you know, it was that kind of moment for a photographer. What do you do? I mean, here's this guy going to be executed. Do you need to, I mean, shouldn't you just walk away? And then there's the other side of the story, for me at least, was, this is what the story's about. This inmate's going to die. He's going to be executed. And really, this is a story. You need to really somehow talk to him, convince him that what you're doing is an important record of this moment in history when Texas is so incredibly active in executing people. And so I stood in front of his cell probably for about a half an hour. I mean, it felt like 2 days, and just looked him right in the eye. And I don't even remember what I said, but at the end of my conversation with him, he said, yes, you can take pictures. I'll sign you release. And if you want, you can come and witness my execution, which I did not chose to do. I cry when I put my dogs down, and I didn't feel like that was something I wanted to keep within my spirit of watching a man be executed by the state. And I followed him. As they moved him to the death watch cell, and then as they moved him to the execution chamber, it was very, very intense. That evening, I was outside the Walls Unit, which is downtown Huntsville, which is where the execution chamber is, a lethal injection, and watched as the witnesses walked in and the witnesses walked out after Richard had been executed.
Did you regret not having made the decision to go in, or do you think that you still documented it by watching it from the outside and photographing it?
No, they wouldn't. I probably would have gone in if they would have allowed me to make photographs, but they do not. I mean, there's been lawsuits. They do not allow anyone to photograph.
Right.
So I, you know, my journalism colleagues say, oh, you should have gone in and witnessed it, you know, but I just didn't want to hold that inside of me. And I can tell you at the end of doing this project, I had nightmares, I had dreams. There would be days when I would wake up and I'd pick up the newspaper and there would be a story about one of the men I met who I sat in his cell and got to know what were executed. And in fact, one of the strange circumstances of this project was that I photographed Todd Willingham. And of course, Todd was profiled in the New Yorker magazine a couple of years back, in which they discovered that the fire forensics, Todd was accused of killing his two children by lighting his house on fire. And it turned out that the fire forensics was basically bogus fire forensics, and everyone, at least a New Yorker writer and many, many other people, basically said Todd did not do the crime, even though he was executed.
And I had photographed Todd.
Yeah. And this became a huge, huge story. And this was some, you know, 12 years, maybe 15 years after I actually did the book. I followed, you know, the man on the road that I photographed, and I last year I did a count, and I want to say about between 65 and 70 of the men that I photographed that are in this book have been executed by the state. So it was a very very powerful experience, and to me a really important book. And when the book came out, which was in 95, there was a very wide distribution of the photographs in magazines. So Newsweek magazine had 6 pages, Parry Match had 8 pages, because no one had ever been in a death row to photograph. And so, you know, it was kind of like full cycle as a photographer. You know, here you are, being able to witness these things and share these stories, which to me is what the power of photography is about, which started with, you know, the What's Going On project, my early activism in 69, of recording this and witnessing it so that people can go back. And one of the great things about the Death Row book is, you know, hopefully in 30 or 40 years, I mean, hopefully in 5 years or 4 years, we'll end the death penalty in America. But there's a living record of what that was about and what we did. And I think the power of photography is really recording these moments, these human moments, these experiences, these struggles, such as the early work, people coming through the border. Because a lot of history gets changed and rewritten, and people's memories are, you know, fleeting. And how do we teach the next generation? And I think, you know, for me, one of the wonderful things about the new book is my friends and people our age, you know, who have shown their kids this book. They've heard kind of stories of what we did in the era, but then to see kids who are 20 or 30 or 40 years old.
We've got 1 minute just to let you know.
Yeah, looking at what we did, this is the power of the book. So I hope that your listeners will grab a copy before they're gone. It's all gone. There's only literally about 175 copies of the book left. They can go to my website and see my work, www.kenlight.com, and click on what's going on and order a copy. Or, of course, they can go to Amazon. And Texas Death Row is sold out, but you can definitely find used copies on Amazon and so forth.
Yeah, and maybe half-price books.
And half-price books, absolutely.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, one final question. Did especially the experience with the Texas Death Row, so which is, I got it, how remarkable that was, and how remarkable the work you did was. Did that leave you with a sense of the power of the picture, even over the power of the word?
Yeah, I've always believed the power of the picture is much stronger than the power of the word, and I say that because I think to one of my favorite photographers, Dorothy Lange, who made the famous Migrant Mother of the Great Depression, and if you ask people about the Great Depression, that image is so powerful in the culture and in people's minds. And if you ask them what have they read about the Great Depression, there's probably not much they've read. And so I think photography has an incredible, incredible power. And I'm just glad that at 18 years old, I picked up the camera and have continued to make photographs.
And so are we.
Thank you.
Ken Light, kenlight.com. The book is the book is What's Going On, Photographs from 1969 to 1974.